KBOO Portland.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series, featuring Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, an ensemble from the worlds of jazz and folk music. The show is Friday, February 21st, 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Sam Ryder has been a U.S. State Department musical ambassador, taking his accordion to at least six nations. For 6 years, Ryder has been band leader for Jazz at the Lincoln Center's youth program. The Human Hands feature the violin stylings of Oregonian Alex Hargraves. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of All Things Must Pass, a 50th anniversary celebration on Saturday, February 1st, from 8 to 11 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. All Things Must Pass was a triple album released by George Harrison in 1970, and this tribute event will feature 30-plus musicians from Portland's music scene who will perform the first four sides of the record. Again, that's All Things Must Pass, a 50th anniversary celebration on Saturday, February 1st, from 8 to 11 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show, with a portion of proceeds donated to the Jeremy Wilson Foundation Musicians Emergency Healthcare Fund. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland. Next up is Preference with your host Hedda, and we'll first listen to This Way Out.
Photojournalist Frances Benjamin Johnston was certainly daring, not just because of her subject matter, but because she entered the field of photography when it was like a club for men only.
She knows that a lot of other trans women from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua that have been murdered because they're trans. But even in the caravan itself, trans women were threatened with violence.
I'm a transgender woman called Lexis Hernandez Alvarez. I'm fighting for all LGBTQ that are being detained by ICE for their freedom to stay in the United States.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. South Korean trans soldier fights discharge, famed photographer flirted with sex and gender, and trans migrants trapped by U.S. asylum crisis. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending January 25th, 2020. South Korea's first out transgender soldier is suing the government for the right to continue her military service. A military panel decided to discharge Staff Sergeant Win Wei Su this week rather than allow her to stay in the Army as a female. Win underwent gender confirmation surgery in Thailand while on leave late last year. She will not be allowed to re-enlist as a female. All able-bodied men are required to serve up to 2 years in the South Korean military, but Win enlisted voluntarily in 2017. Transgender people are legally banned from joining the military, but no regulations cover a service member who transitions while on active duty. Win says she had intended to transition after finishing her service, but the years of anxiety and depression got the best of her. As she told a press conference this week, after she transitioned, she felt much better. Win wore fatigues to the press conference and saluted the assembled reporters, saying, "I'm a soldier of the Republic of Korea." She vowed to take her case all the way to the country's highest court if necessary. In an emotional statement, she pleaded, "I want to show everyone that I can be one of the great soldiers defending this country. Please give me that chance." South Korea has already faced international criticism for outlawing consensual same-gender sex in the military, even though it's legal in civilian life. One Seoul-based human rights group called Wayne's forced discharge truly cruel.
Israel and Russia signed an agreement this week that bans Israeli same-gender couples from adopting Russian children. The move came ahead of Vladimir Putin's January 23rd visit to attend the Fifth World Holocaust Forum. Embattled Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition government took heavy fire from opposition parties for the action. Left-wing opposition Meretz party leader Nitzan Horowitz called the agreement a spit in the face of the LGBT community. Lawmaker Eitan Ginsburg of the even more progressive New Blue and White Party said that the Netanyahu government is preventing us from being parents. He called it a continuation of Israel's discriminatory policies. According to the Jerusalem Post, the two countries also signed agreements involving agriculture, energy, and pensions for immigrants from the former Soviet Union. Meanwhile, Israel's Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit overruled Jerusalem's municipal government this week. The city is ordered to allow anti-queer billboards to be posted ahead of a scheduled pride parade. City officials demanded their removal ahead of a pride celebration in June 2019. The billboards directly attack LGBTQ families with the message, "A father and a mother equals a family." Mandelblit called it a valid expression of opposition to statements made during this pride event. The right-wing group Hazan is responsible for the billboards. The Jerusalem Post says that they've already spent a lot of advertising money promoting anti-equality causes.
A U.S. federal appeals court has upheld the right of eight married Indiana lesbian mothers to have both of their respective spouses listed as parents on their children's birth certificates. A lower court ruled for the plaintiffs in June 2016, but the state's Republican Attorney General, Curtis Hill, appealed. The 7th U.S. Court of Appeals upheld the original ruling by Federal District Judge Tanya Walton Pratt on January 17th. Pratt wrote that forcing the non-biological parent in a legal marriage with a same-gender partner to undergo the time and expense of adopting their spouse's child was discriminatory. The 7th Circuit agreed, saying that having both parents listed on birth certificates was among the constellation of benefits that the states have linked to marriage. The 7th Circuit ordered the state of Indiana to update all its relevant statutes to allow co-parent names on the birth certificates of same-gender couples. The rulings of the 7th Circuit cover Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. It's not yet clear if Indiana will appeal the latest ruling. If not, the decision will only directly affect queer parents in those three states. The court itself noted that the original ruling could even be defined more narrowly to not apply to gay male couples, since all the plaintiffs in the lawsuit were lesbians. The appeals court charged the state legislature with fixing that complication.
The Atlanta-based U.S. fast food chain Chick-fil-A has failed to make inroads in the U.K., at least in part because of protests against the unabashed homophobia of the restaurant chain's management. Anti-discrimination activists managed to shut down the first U.K. outlet in a shopping center in the British town of Reading. Shopping center owners declined to extend the outlet's lease beyond a 6-month trial period. Now, Chick-fil-A's last remaining restaurant in the U.K., located at McDonald Aviemore Resort in the Scottish Highlands, quietly shuttered its doors on January 18th. Scottish Green Party co-leader Patrick Harvey had called for a boycott of other McDonald's facilities across the country, urging the resort company's management to end their commercial relationship with sponsors of prejudice and hatred. CEO Dan Cathy is an evangelical Christian who vocally opposes marriage equality on religious grounds. Chick-fil-A offers franchisees the recipe for a crowd-pleasing chicken sandwich, and franchise owners are required to close on Sundays for the Christian Sabbath. Reputable news outlets have reported that its management has funneled millions of corporate dollars into anti-queer groups and causes over many years. Despite public relations comments to the contrary, that practice reportedly continues. A spokesperson for Chick-fil-A told HeraldScotland.com simply that, "We look forward to having a permanent location in the UK in the future."
Meanwhile, officials in San Antonio, Texas, have been forced to spend more than $300,000 defending their decision to block a Chick-fil-A outlet from opening at the city's international airport. The Trump administration also ordered a federal investigation into the city council's March 2019 decision to block the sandwich peddler from food court space because of its documented financial support for anti-queer groups. Local San Antonio TV outlet KENS puts the legal cost to the city thus far at $315,000. The city is defending two lawsuits, one filed by the Anti-Queer San Antonio Family Association and a separate suit lodged by the notoriously homophobic Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed what was called the Save Chick-fil-A bill that was passed by the Republican-controlled Texas legislature in July 2019. It bans any adverse action against anyone based, wholly or partly, on a person's sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction, including beliefs or convictions regarding marriage. San Antonio First Assistant Attorney Liz Provencio said that they'll continue to argue that the city did nothing wrong and certainly did not violate any law, and we will continue to vigorously defend the city's interests.
Australia is currently suffering through unimaginable bushfires that have killed dozens of humans and millions of animals and incinerated thousands of homes. But embattled evangelical Christian Prime Minister Scott Morrison may not have thought about the unintended hellfire when his administration crafted its so-called religious discrimination bill. While it would ostensibly protect people's religious liberty, critics call it a license to discriminate. It would allow bigots to withhold goods or services to LGBTQ people based on opposition to civil equality. The government is currently accepting submissions on the measure from the public. A submission by the Noosa Queensland Temple of Satan claims that the religious discrimination bill is unnecessary and a waste of the federal government's time. However, the submission adds that if the proposal becomes law, then Satanists across Australia will aggressively use this law to ensure that we can access all the privileges it guarantees. That includes installing Satanist chaplains in schools with government support. While some of its promises may be tongue-in-cheek, the group warns that passage of the bill would open the gates of hell onto the streets of Australia, and urged others to submit their own submissions about the bill. The deadline fast approaches.
Finally, a Republican group called Defending Democracy Together supports the impeachment of U.S. President Donald Trump and also favors the resulting elevation of Vice President Mike Pence to the presidency, grudgingly. The group's website banner says of the infamously anti-queer Veep, "Well, I guess he'll do." It's set to run an ad with that sentiment on Trump's favorite TV outlet, Fox News. Their 30-second TV ad supporting a Pence presidency sets a very low bar for the new homophobe in chief.
Mike Pence doesn't brag about sexually assaulting women.
Grab him by the I can do anything.
Mike Pence doesn't pressure foreign governments into investigating his political rivals.
Ukraine should start an investigation into the Biden.
Mike Pence doesn't mock and make fun of people with handicaps.
You gotta see this guy. I don't know what I said.
Donald Trump is being impeached. It's time for President Pence. At least it's an improvement.
Meanwhile, evidence continues to surface linking Pence directly to the Ukraine scandal for which Trump has been impeached. Maybe he's not so much of an improvement after all.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending January 25th, 2020. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to NewsWrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
There's nothing cooler than the world's only international LGBT radio magazine.
Unless it's thiswayout.org.
At thiswayout.org, you'll find program information,
related videos,
expanded features,
NewsWrap transcripts,
and CDs and downloadable material.
It might not be cooler than radio,
but there's much more This Way Out at thiswayout.org.
The letter reads, "Happy New Year. Your family and all the LGBTQ all over the world that I love. I'm fighting for myself, to be free and show the world that I'm a transgender woman called Lexis Hernandez Alvarez.
Demás personas, no hay empleo.
She's trans and that they're discriminated really fiercely over there, and that in general that there's a lot of discrimination and that there's no opportunity for people there.
Images from one side of the U.S.-Mexico border crisis to the other. But first, a photojournalist who crossed several boundaries.
The woman behind the camera, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Photojournalist Frances Benjamin Johnston was certainly daring, not just because of her subject matter, but because she entered the field of photography when it was like a club for men only. As a young woman in the late 1800s, she got her hands on one of George Eastman's newfangled lightweight cameras, and by the turn of the century had her own studio in Washington, D.C., taking portraits of famous people like Susan B. Anthony and Booker T. Washington. Her own self-portrait showed her as a new woman, skirts hiked to the knee, holding a cigarette in one hand and a beer stein in the other. In another, she posed in front of a bicycle dressed as a man with a false mustache. Mind you, these were Victorian times, but then again, flouting social conventions was her stick. After a distinguished career as a photojournalist, Frances Benjamin Johnston bequeathed over 20,000 photographs to the Library of Congress in 1952. She's best known for photographing the rich and famous, but her work speaks of an inquisitive eye, resulting in artful images of coal miners and iron workers, female nudes, world fairs, and even historic architecture. Early in her career, with lighting trickery of her own, she also captured breathtaking photographs of Mammoth Cave. As official White House photographer for five presidents, Johnston snapped the last photo of President McKinley at the 1901 Pan American Exposition just minutes before he was assassinated. While Johnston never married, letters indicate her romantic attachment to another woman, Mattie Edwards Hewitt, with whom she lived and worked for 6 years. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mary Gay Hutcherson.
Mr. Giuliani stated that the president, quote, basically knows what I'm doing. Sure, as his lawyer.
From the audiobook of The Whistleblower's Complaint, the report that sparked the investigation of U.S. President Donald Trump.
Mr. Giuliani also stated, quote, we're not meddling in an election. We're meddling in an investigation, which we have a right to do, because that information will be very, very helpful to my client.
Get rid of her.
Correct.
Okay, get her out tomorrow. I don't care. Get her out tomorrow. Take her out. Okay?
Excellent.
Do it.
Hey, everybody. This is Leah Delaria.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
This is Janice Ian.
We are the three amigos.
And you are listening to This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
That was without cue cards, people.
Hay una mujer desaparecida. Hay una mujer desaparecida.
Gut-wrenching images of terrified children being separated from their desperate parents tell the story most people have heard about the ongoing immigration crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. The distress of trans people caught up in the humanitarian disaster is often overlooked. KMUD News Director Lauren Schmidt reports from both sides of the border about trans women fighting for justice.
On Saturday, January 11th, hundreds gathered at the Yuba County Jail, where a diverse crowd of organizations, activists, and protesters were demonstrating their opposition to the jail's recently renewed contract with ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The Yuba County Jail is currently housing around 200 undocumented immigrants and is the only remaining ICE facility in Northern California. Despite Governor Gavin Newsom signing Assembly Bill 32 in December, marking California as the first state to ban privately run immigrant detention centers and prisons, the contract between ICE and the Yuba County Jail was recently renewed. Even before renewing their contract with ICE, the Yuba County Jail has been cited for inhumane conditions for decades. There have been numerous suicide attempts within the facility, and late last year, around 20 detainees participated in a hunger strike, sparking a response from officials. Although crossing the border without official permission is considered a civil offense by United States law, many immigrants have become criminalized. A large number of undocumented immigrants were brought to the United States as children. However, even if that child attempted to apply for citizenship as an adult, they would automatically be disqualified due to the nature of their initial entry, even if they have since married a U.S. citizen. Basically, if you cross into the United States and are living in the United States undocumented, the chances of you ever becoming legal is little to none. Sadly, many immigration lawyers know this, yet still accept money from families who will never see the outcome they so desire. For all of these reasons, people from around the state have been traveling to protest at the Yuba County Jail for over a year now. I was at the largest one yet at this location on January 11th. The day was filled with powerful speeches, taiko drumming, and even a surprise cameo from detainees currently in ICE custody, who were screaming from the cage rooftop of the jail. I could hear them shouting their names and please don't forget me, like so many others who have been left behind by a broken system. Like Lexis Hernandez Alvarez, a trans woman who is currently in ICE custody despite spending the majority of her life in the United States. Josh Kaizuka with the Japanese American Citizens League shared her story with the crowd.
She was born a boy, brought into this country at the age of one. She had a very traumatic childhood. Not everybody understood her identity, her struggles. Her parents, especially her father and brothers, punished her for her gender non-conforming behaviors. Later on in life, she made a mistake, did her time, and as she was being released, taken into ICE custody. Since then, she'd been housed in the Yuba County Jail. She was made to wear men's clothing, housed with men, denied necessary medical treatment. Then, a few weeks ago, on Christmas, the deputies here came to her and said, "You're gonna get released." She called her family. She told them, "I'm coming home. I'll be with you." They took her to the Bay Area ICE facility. Instead of releasing her, they shipped her off to Texas, where she is now. She didn't even have a chance to contact her attorney in San Francisco. Her public defender, San Francisco, has filed an appeal. We're fortunate enough to have received a letter from her to be read to you. And to read that, I'm introducing Son Mane.
A trans youth approached the crowd.
So the letter reads, "Happy New Year, your family and all the LGBTQ all over the world that I love. I'm showing the world my love for all transgender people, that I'm not just doing this for myself. I'm doing it also for the loss of transgender lives that are loved by spirit, by these families and friends that are still fighting for LGBTQ equality, and also for trans equality. I say this because I'm fighting for myself to be free and show the world that I'm a transgender woman called Lexis Hernandez Alvarez. I know right now I'm going through something scary in my life, far away from friends and family, but it's okay. I'm still me. Like the book you send me, to call Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality by Sarah McBride, a transgender woman, forwarded by Joe Biden. I love this book and everything about it. Sarah McBride is making me stronger every day that goes by for me. I wish I could tell her that in person, and I tell her I'm fighting this for her as well, because I changed as a person, even if they are still looking at me as a bad person. But it's okay. I understand that there are laws in this world, but like my lawyer told me, I have to keep going and fighting for what I believe in. I love to hear that from people that care for me, and what I'm fighting for is for all LGBTQ to have this freedom, to make a change for all LGBTQ that are fighting for their freedom to stay in the United States, that are being detained by ICE. Yes, I am an immigrant, but in my heart, I am American. I have been living in the United States since I was a one-year-old child, and I will always be American, and I say this with love. I would love for all people like me to know my story, to let them know that they aren't alone. For all the LGBTQ all over the world, also family and friends and LGBTQ that passed away as well. You are always loved in spirit. Alexis Hernandez Alvarez."
Sadly, this isn't the first time I've seen the trans community under attack due to a flawed immigration or asylum process. While reporting in Mexico just over a year ago, I met around 100 trans women who were in the heavily politicized migrant caravan from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Though all of the migrants were being harassed and attacked, the trans migrants probably had it the worst, as they faced violence within the caravan itself due to religious bigotry. So when the caravan initially arrived to Tijuana, Mexico, the approximately 100 trans women and men were pushed to the front. Because of this, they were the first to get attacked by homophobic Mexican nationalists who were causing violence all over the city. The mayor of Tijuana, Juan Manuel Gastelum, condoned the violence, saying, quote, "Human rights are only for right humans." The mayor sports a red ball cap that says "Make Tijuana Great Again," despite Tijuana having a rich history of migrants. Sound familiar? But a great man once said, "Hope will never be silent." And a group of queer punks opened up their warehouse cafe hostel to all trans migrants. I took a trip to Enclave Caracol, where I spoke with Catalina, a trans woman who had recently been attacked, but was happy to have a safe place for her and her friends while they applied for political asylum.
Catalina, ¿dónde? De Honduras. La primero, yo soy una chica trans y nosotras somos discriminadas, entonces hay mucha violencia en contra de nosotras. Y la población en general, no hay oportunidades para las demás personas, no hay empleo.
She's trans, and that they're discriminated really viciously over there, and that in general there's a lot of discrimination, and that there's no opportunity for people there.
From traveling, how have the travels been so far?
Okay, el viaje para nosotras siempre fue difícil desde que salimos de nuestros países, porque hay más chicas que son de El Salvador, de Nicaragua, de Guatemala también. Hay mucha violencia en contra de las chicas trans, hay muchas que han sido asesinadas, entonces nosotros tenemos miedo, por eso salimos de nuestro país y miramos que era la oportunidad en la caravana, de ir con la caravana.
That they saw their chance to leave the country because of the caravan, the safety, because she knows that a lot of other trans people, trans women from, also from Guatemala, El Salvador, in Nicaragua, that have been murdered because they are trans. And so, yeah, using the caravan to get here safely. But even in the caravan itself, that trans women were threatened with violence, that they were going to be raped, that they were going to be murdered, and a lot of them were beaten. There was a lot of people that were against gay people, against trans people. They came to Playa de Tijuana because there's a shelter there right on the close to the beach. Border Angels runs the shelter. People from Tijuana showed up to attack them. Trans women wanted to get together and find a safe space so that they can then cross to the United States. And then they realized that they were running a lot of risks over there, dangerous risks, and they came back here. They're waiting. They're petitioning for asylum in the United States, and they're still waiting because I haven't really told them anything on their status.
In the end, Catalina wanted people to know that not everyone within the caravan was homophobic or hateful, and a lot of them were really nice to her. She could relate to them because, after all, everyone is just looking for a place where they can exist without the threat of rape or murder. Although Catalina and the other trans migrants were in a terrible situation, something positive did happen. Shortly after my visit, Casa Arco Iris, Rainbow House, was created. In a major act of solidarity, members of Enclave Caracol created a grassroots organization to support LGBTQI migrants as they prepare to petition asylum in the United States, Canada, or even adapt to their new lives in Tijuana and other parts of Mexico. Casa Arco Iris also operates as a shelter and offers access to legal services, health care, and counseling. They also need support. You can learn more at casaarcoiris.org/ES. That's CASAARCOIRIS.org/ES. Reporting from a sanctuary county in Northern California, this has been Lauren Schmidt for This Way Out.
It's taken a couple of deaths, but the plight of trans migrants and asylum seekers is getting more attention. More than 40 U.S. House representatives have signed a letter to ICE calling for the release of all trans people in their custody. The letter specifically mentions Roxana Hernandez and Johanna Medina Leon, who both died due to inadequate care in privately owned detention centers like the one in Lauren Schmidt's report. A coalition of over 80 advocacy groups have echoed that demand, highlighting the case of Kelly Gonzalez Aguilar. Gonzalez's condition is deteriorating after more than 2 years in detention. Meanwhile, the New Mexico group Santa Fe Dreamers Project is warning that a trans woman identified as J.H. may die if she is not released to a hospital soon. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Carol Myers and John Dyer V, produced by Brian DeShazer, from Mary Gay Hutcherson, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and from Lauren Schmidt. Holly Neer and Ronnie Gelbert performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Christopher Matthews, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, together with all of our listener donors. They make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KUNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, WRFI Watkins Glen, New York, to MTM Cunamble, New South Wales, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Now y'all stay tuned.
That is Seth Kaufman from Cascadilla. It's a piece called The Rails. I heard it first on public radio in New York City, that little piece of music, and I've listened to it on repeat all these 12 years since. It was in January, actually, that I first heard it. It was right after my birthday. And speaking of birthdays, happy birthday to Soumya.
Happy belated birthday, Alan.
Thank you. How was your birthday?
It was awesome. What did you do for your birthday?
I spent time with people.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, it was a nice melody, and I wasn't, you know, I didn't wake up super excited. You know, it just was.
Do you ever wake up super excited?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And today I realized that I low-keyed my own birthday so much that I am disappointed and I want another shot.
I feel you. I know what you mean. Okay, I'll let you yap.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to hear from Sasha Buchert in a little bit. And we have some music queued up for her. Folks, feel free to call in. Sasha is not only staff attorney with Lambda Legal and formerly with the Transgender Law Center in Oakland, but Sasha is alumna of the station. She used to co-host Out Loud, and before that was a newsroom volunteer. So a lot of experience here at KABU before heading around the country to do good work. So we had a chance. And folks can call in to talk with Sasha or to wish Somia a happy birthday. 503-231-8187. That's the studio. When Somia answers, feel free to cheer her on for another great year coming up. This is Preference. This is the Cutie Boo slot. Preference and Trans Positive take turns in this slot week by week. So tune in next week and see what the folks with Trans Positive have to bring you on the radio. We're grateful. Sasha is on the phone, I'm told. Can you hear me?
Hi, Alan.
Fabulous. How are you?
Good. How are you?
A little older and a lot wiser, certainly.
Oh, good.
Yeah, how are you?
You know, I'm it's winter here. It's a winter, so yeah. That's an adjustment, but I'm good.
Yeah, is there snow and sleet and people screaming because they were cold and gross and wet?
Exactly.
Yeah, why don't you yeah, and you used to work, I mentioned Lambda Legal and TLC. I forgot for a moment that you worked for Basic Rights Oregon.
Yeah, I loved working for Basic Rights Oregon. Volunteered at the Q Center. I've got deep roots in Portland. Hey, Portland.
Yay.
Love you.
Q Center's ED, Cameron Witten, is running for Metro Council.
Yay!
So if folks don't have a sense of what it is that Metro does, go read up. Go ask people. Talk to people about it. There's a lot they do, and they really do cinch the Metro area together, I think. Along with your voting, you should get a sense of how complex local government really is and how duties are separated and who's responsible for what. I think this comes up especially for attempts to build services for homeless populations because, well, the duties are, you know, the responsibilities are spread out among agencies and actual governments. So I encourage you to get educated on all of that. Sasha, we haven't talked about this. I don't know if you've heard that Sam Adams is running for city council.
I did, yeah. I heard that through the email, and I don't want to delve into the C4 area here too much, but I will say that I have really positive memories of when I was in Portland. One of the big campaigns that we were working on at the time at Basic Rights Oregon was trying to, you know, move the case forward for providing fully inclusive healthcare benefits for trans folks. And, you know, this was back in 2010, 2011. And it was before, you know, the states had issued bulletins prohibiting categorical exclusions. And I will say I was really impressed with Sam's leadership in moving a vote to city, move city council forward and voting for trans inclusive care for city workers. You know, it was a huge step forward at the time, and you know, there was a standing ovation after it happened at City Hall, and it was a pretty special moment. And you know, it was when Sam was mayor, and I was really impressed and thought the world of the work that he did in providing that kind of leadership. You know, so I will say that for sure.
Yeah. Thank you for it.
Yeah, and I don't have anything negative to say about any of the rest of his record either. I just that's the one direct experience I have that I want to make sure people don't forget, because I feel like that was a really impressive moment for him in the city.
Yeah. Folks are free to call in and share their thoughts as well.
503-231-8187. Yeah, sorry to hear about Commissioner Fish too. That was sad to hear.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And you know, as a result, we've got four city council races at once. That includes this mayor, I guess that's what you call him. I suspect he'd prefer a different title, Mr. Wheeler. And I'm curious to see if he'll be the mayor who sticks it out for a second term. Policy considerations aside, there's lots to critique there. I remember that Mr. Wheeler put out a press release the day after the election in autumn 2016, and he talked about how he would protect the city from Trump, and that the rest of us, the peasants, I guess, should go out and check in with our neighbors, chat with our neighbors, socialize, as though we needed to be given instructions about how to respond to changes in our world from him. And as though he somehow became our real father who would take care of us and protect us, at least with his words, if nothing else. And I have to say, just sort of on that those principles, you know, you could toss some words around and say that he's paternalistic, his behavior is anti-democratic. I do think that ethos of he's the adult and we are the children and should mostly stay out of the way, and that if our voices are to be heard, it's an indulgence on his part that he'd be willing to listen. I feel like nothing has contradicted that sensibility of his. I don't think that he's interested in what people have to say, and he certainly doesn't solicit it or respond to it for the most part. In fact, I remember there was a gentleman for a while on his Facebook page, some friend of his or employee, I don't know, I never knew, who, if anyone criticized Mr. Wheeler, this person would message and offer to sit down and explain Ted Wheeler's point of view to them, since they were a critic, which isn't really how I think mayoring is supposed to work. I think mayoring is supposed to involve more listening than mayorsplaining. So, I don't know. I would love for a more robust, more inclusive, more egalitarian, more honest and human political system.
Yeah. Are there going to be any debates coming up anytime soon? Or is that later in the year?
Well, the primaries are between, the primary season, I guess, is between now and May. And I haven't heard of any scheduled. And I think people can still join in the race, though it's too late for campaign finance matching funds. I think that deadline has passed. And I haven't been able to find a single compilation of everyone who's running for the four seats, let alone include Metro and the county. So if anybody has that list, we'd love to get it tacked up on our wall here if there is some comprehensive list of all announced candidates. Philip Wolf is running for, I believe he's running for mayor. He's definitely running for city council. I can't off the top of my head remember which seat. And he's a queer man, and he's deaf, and he's really devoted to access issues for folks with different needs. And he's really passionate, heart of gold, and it beats big. So it's certainly worth tuning in and finding out what Mr. Wolf has to offer the city. That's a lot of what I know. Actually, I'll note that before we move along, that openly gay former mayor Sam Adams is running against openly bisexual current city commissioner Chloe Daly. So. So there's that. Anyway, what are you up to? It's not softball season.
good. Really great. Yeah. on the LGBT front, I want to remind folks that we're expecting a huge decision, you know, from the Supreme Court probably in a few months. It could be any time, really. You know, usually they issue the big decisions in June, but just want to remind people that, you know, they heard oral arguments in October on this question of whether federal law protects LGBT people in employment. And, you know, we're on pins and needles, you know, because that could have, you know, massive impact on the lives of LGBT people across the country, especially in places where, you know, unlike Oregon, you know, which, you know, because of, you know, the great work that's been done there, you know, there are, you know, explicit statewide non-discrimination protections for LGBT folks. But, you know, in places where people experience the most discrimination, you might argue, where there aren't explicit protections, you know, the impact of a bad decision could be, you know, pretty significant. So, you know, there's a lot of concern about, you know, how they're going to rule. You know, it's just there's also concern that they're going to take up other cases. And of course, there's other issues, you know, like DACA that, you know, we're waiting to hear from the court on. So just wanted to remind folks that that was happening. So that's a big part of our world right now. You know, there's a lot of legislation, as you know, across the country again this year from state legislatures attacking LGBT folks. Specifically, the bills that we're seeing are bills that would allow state-funded adoption agencies to deny LGBT parents the ability to adopt, you know, religiously affiliated child adoption agencies. They get funding from the government, so they would get taxpayer money and then turn around and use that to discriminate against LGBT families. There's a bill that was passed recently in Tennessee that would do that. And then we're seeing a lot of bills, too, that would prohibit doctors from providing health care to trans minors in South Dakota. There's a bill that has already moved through one committee that we're, you know, concerned about, and copycat bills in other southern, or that's, yes, definitely southern, but Midwest and other places in the country. So those are a couple of the bills that we're concerned about. There's others, too, I'm happy to talk about, but that's what we're mainly seeing right now.
Is there a push or a move to, well, let's just take an easy, you know, easy to, at least easy for me to understand, example of gay marriage, same-sex marriage. So there are a lot of places like Oregon that never instituted or never approved it or never, you know, there is no, gay marriage in Oregon outside of sort of the national right to it. Is there, so it seems to me that as federal rights shrink, or when they do, states have an opportunity to step up and sort of rebuild them. I know it's a less than ideal way to do it, but you do what you got to do. And is there a push? Do you see any push for states that rely on, that happily rely on federal protections, developing state replacements? Does that make sense? My language here isn't super clear, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some gaps, you know, that, you know, states are concerned with, and there's things that, you know, states can do. I mean, I think you know, we're maybe thinking of apples and oranges here, but a little bit. But you know, there's you know, what I was thinking of were the states that, you know, don't have, you know, a state like Oklahoma, for example, it doesn't have statewide non-discrimination protections like, you know, Oregon enjoys, with the Equality Act that was passed there in 2007 that prohibits employers, for example, from discriminating against you because you're LGBT. You know, so if you went to try to get a job somewhere and they said, I'm not going to hire you because you're trans, that would be, you know, a form of employment discrimination, and that isn't legal in Oregon. Whereas if you were in Oklahoma, you know, that question would be much different because you wouldn't be able to rely on state law. You could only have, you know, because there are no clear non-discrimination protections, you know, so you wouldn't be able to bring a state case and a state claim. You'd have to rely on federal law, which would make be much more difficult with a bad Supreme Court decision. I think in states like Oregon, there's probably areas of law that, you know, it's not, you know, as you know, it's not black and white. There's a lot of gray in the law. And for example, even though Obergefell, marriage equality is the law of the land, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, from with, you know, affiliated with conservative groups often that try to, you know, turn it into skim milk. You know, they want to be able to, you know, move forward policies that would allow employers to not provide benefits to same-sex couples, you know, under the same terms that they offer it to, you know, opposite-sex couples. And the reasoning they would, you know, make, you know, and especially in places without explicit protections, like Texas, for example, they would argue that, you know, that Obergefell doesn't talk about employer benefits. It just talks about marriage. And so that's the kind of, you know, distinguishing, you know, that's the kind of distinguishing that, you know, folks are trying to make, you know, that would water down, you know, that the freedom to marry. So, you know, I think there's one, you know, answering the question, I think the question is maybe what Oregon can do, you know, or states like Oregon, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, are, you know, quote, blue states. And, you know, there's a big piece of this is, you know, I think this is being done to some degree, but, you know, it's to, you know, to demand that state legislators take a stand in stating that, you know, the actions taken by, you know, sister governments like in Tennessee that, you know, advance these policies, you know, that, you know, that that's not something that, you know, Oregon will tolerate, and, you know, they're and stop, you know, taxpayer funded, you know, travel to those states. Don't have any conferences in those states. You know, I feel like the power of the purse is really effective, you know, in a lot of these fights, as we saw with the HB2 fight in North Carolina, when, you know, I know a lot of with businesses, for example, but, you know, it's not just businesses, it's government, you know. So I think it's the power of the purse in saying that, you know, this is not something that we're gonna sanction in any way, you know. So not just with, you know, verbal condemnations or resolutions and but with also with money. I think money talks with a lot of these, you know, issues, you know, in a way that sometimes, you know, we can't get our voices heard in the same way through community action. So I think that that's helpful.
Thanks for that. Just a, it's entirely speculative, but I try to always throw in at least one question that you'll just have to make up an answer to. how much do you think California state government is able to essentially wall off its state from D.C., effective do you think that is? Do you have any idea? Does the West Coast have some ability to really just put a wall in between and say, okay, you know?
I mean, I think it has done that to some degree. I think the West Coast, you know, meaning Washington, Oregon, California, I think have passed, you know, a lot of protections in the last few years that, you know, are much, much higher than anything the federal government has to offer. So I think it's done, you know, a lot of work to protect, you know, it's the people that live in those states. So I think that's already happened to some degree, you know, and making sure that, you know, people aren't, you know, harmed by the any actions from the federal government. You know, there is some concerns about funding. You know, I think it's the same tool that's being used in the other way against, you know, the Trump administration, for example, that wants to defund, you know, programs unless they discriminate against vulnerable communities. So I think that, you know, that's a fight. I think we have to remember that, you know, again, going back to the power of the purse, that a lot of the states in the West Coast are, you know, economic powerhouses and you know, are able to have the revenue of, you know, many small countries, as everyone knows. And I'm really talking out of school. This is not the best expertise.
I promise you.
I can't believe I'm trying to. Sorry, Portland. Can we get back to LGBT issues?
It's all one giant queer issue.
It is. Everything's connected.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're right.
We have about a minute left, and then we're going to play a song.
Yay.
Play a song dedicated to you. So, do you have last?
Wonderful.
Yeah. Do you have last thoughts for my birthday or Somya's or?
Oh, anything? No! I hope you have a. You know, I know it's a little past your birthday, so I hope it was really wonderful and you're having a wonderful day. And thanks for all the work that you do and bringing your voice and thoughts to the radio and for our community. And thanks, KBOO, for doing everything you do. And now everybody listening to KBOO, please keep supporting our radio and our community. Thank you.
Yeah, if you're not able to donate now, pledge. We've got a late winter pledge drive coming up the second week of February. So tune in that Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I'd love to hear from you. All right. Why don't you give us a final thought?
Stay warm. Drink some hot tea. Love yourself. Give yourself a hug. You too, Ellen.
What's in?
You too, Ellen.
Thank you. All right. Here's a song for Sasha. Let's see if we can get this to play. Nothing there. Can you hear it? I can't. Why is that funny? I can't hear anything.
Thank you. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of When We Cry on Sunday, February 2nd from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Siren Theater in Portland. When We Cry takes a look into the pain of a Black woman, seeking to bring awareness to the effects women endure when they remain silent. Again, that's When We Cry on Sunday, February 2nd from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at the Siren Theater, 315 Northwest Davis Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Classical Music Confidential on Monday, February 10th from 11 a.m. to noon at the Central Library Branch at the Multnomah County Library in Portland. Classical Music Confidential will be hosted by Bruce Charles and will take a look at Portland's secret classical music past of the 1940s. Again, that's Classical Music Confidential on Monday, February 10th.